A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
The master fighter of our time. But not even he could imagine the power of the indestructible man he is about to face. A creation of science whose only thought is to survive.
Can't you hear you?
The unstoppable terror of silent rage. Now, Chuck Norris must destroy him.
Dan, watch out!
In a final battle to the death and beyond. Silent Rage.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 265, Silent Rage.
Silent Rage.
To quote Homer Simpson, I'm full of rage-a-hol.
I'm a rage-a-holic, the sweet, sweet rage. Right. Something along those lines. Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of rage in this movie.
Hmm.
And yes, I guess you would call it silent as well. a lot of times with these...
I tend to internalize my rage. I don't know about you, but maybe you've been known to put your fist through the drywall.
I only internalize it when you're around.
Oh, thank you.
I'm holding everything back, you know? But yeah, this is a movie that stars a mutual favorite of ours. Good old Chucky, Chuck Norris.
Mm-hmm.
Charles, perhaps his parents.
Exactly. The king of kung fu and badassery and ball-busting hijinks.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of ball-busting, have you ever seen... It's been widely circulated all over social media. Those ads for the... That must come out in the late 70s, early 80s, what have you. Chuck Norris action pants, which basically just look like a pair of Jordache jeans that...
Pre-shrunk,
They were basically dungaree cutoffs, and there's Chucky doing this massive high kick wearing these crazy pants, short as they can be, and a tucked in work shirt with short shirt sleeves, and he looked as manly as you can get.
That's true.
I don't think anybody could look more manlier in a pair of short shorts than good old Chuck Norris did in that particular advertisement.
As a business journalist, that's a real head-scratcher to me, because the target audience appears to be denim wearers who want to high-kick someone. So I don't know, that's an incredibly segmented market.
It's a very niche audience, yeah. People who like to wear denim, but at the same time like their knees to be free in the summertime. They don't want to cover it up, so they want to wear they want the short version of the denim pants, and they want to kick someone smack dab in the face.
Many a time have I ripped a favorite pair of dress pants as a roundhouse kicks someone in a bar fight. I mean, this is clearly addressing pressing consumer needs, but we love our Chuck, and we this is pre-canon Chuck, pre-Braddock. Mm-hmm. Pre-Missing in Action, pre-Invasion USA, yep. One of my all-time favorites. And this is a little bit of a departure for our sort of reticent, quiet fellow here. Taking on a more, dare I say, dramatic role.
Well, I mean, at the time, Chuck Norris, this was as you said, pre-canon Chuck Norris. This is pre-meme Chuck Norris, all those Chuck Norris jokes. Honestly, I can't even think of one at the moment. Any crossing your mind?
None.
what does Chuck Norris say to your mama? I don't know. Yeah. Chuck Norris. Something yeah, along exactly. those lines. Who the hell cares?
Yeah.
Chuck Norris became an icon based, I think, on those canon films that he would, you know, your Invasion USAs, your Delta Forces, your Missing in Actions, and on and on and on. All their sort of sequels. I mean, it's been said in many a documentary on canon that basically the company, the studio, was built on the backs of the two Chucks. One being Norris, the other one being Bronson. This is before that. This is his, I believe, fifth or sixth film. And up to this point, he really was known as almost like the great white hope of martial artists. I mean, he worked with Bruce Lee. He did a couple other films before this. I'm not a Chuck Norris expert, so I don't. Mm. I can't exactly. I think one was called The Octagon. I think another one was.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if he did.
That's where he's, I believe, being communicated with telepathically. So it's really a lot of fun.
I think one was called Good Guys Wear Black or something. But all these movies would always present him as in the martial arts vein, whereas in this one, he actually had to stretch his limiting acting chops just a wee bit, because this one, he's. Yes, of course, the martial arts do come into play, but it's not so much at the forefront. This is almost a pseudo-horror film. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of people, I just got this on IMDb, so I say a lot of people, but some people actually refer to this as Chuck Norris versus the Terminator, because in a lot of ways, he's going up against, I mean, I guess you could say he's the unstoppable force versus the immovable object.
Yeah,
so
indeed.
So how did we get this immovable object? Well, the movie starts off, not so much a prologue, just kind of showing us a guy, and he's going apeshit.
Yeah.
His family's going apeshit, and he's obviously
wigged to the tits on pills and booze and God knows what. He's flipping out. Mm-hmm. He grabs an axe.
He calls his doctor first. He says, "Doc, I need help. I'm losing it." He says it three times, each time more sinister. So he knows that he's slipping, but unfortunately, the response of the doctor is a little bit too late, because he grabs his axe and just kills two people. One, I believe, was his wife.
Yeah, or landlady. It's been a couple days since I've seen this. Amazing it should leave the memory bank so quickly. Mm-hmm. But anyway, of course, Texas finest are brought in, and that includes Chuck Norris and his sidekick, who's incredibly inefficacious, shall we say. He's kind of a portly, sort of doughy fellow who is reticent to get involved in any fisticuffs. It stands in stark contrast to Chuck Norris's very willingness to lay down the fists when required. This guy almost doesn't even want to be a cop. I believe his name is, in my notes I call him Fat Charlie. Poor Charlie. And I think he's new to the force. Actually, he's just kind of chunky. Mm-hmm. Like a soup, and he just doesn't want any part of anything. But
well, he kind of does. I mean, in a sense, I mean, I think he definitely feels like he's out of his depth, and in so many ways he is, because you know, I mean, when Chuck comes onto the scene after this horrific murder to start investigating, and right away I'm like, oh, here comes Walker Texas Ranger.
Yeah.
So in many ways, this was almost like a precursor of Chuck Norris's career to come, because
sheriff, cowboy hat, Texas, small podunk town, mm-hmm. has all the hallmarks.
And he shows up with his deputy, Charlie, aka Lenny, played by, I call him Lenny, because he has a story when he talks about, he has to unburden himself when he's like, why was this guy even hired? Let me ask you that, because like, is a talent pool, like, yes, okay, this might be a small podunk Texas town, but you got to think the talent pool for deputies is just a little bit deeper than this, because this poor guy, did I mention he was played by Stephen Furst?
No.
Well, I'm mentioning it now. Stephen Furst, who I know from Animal House and St. Elsewhere, another show that I never watched in my life, but I remember hearing, okay, Stephen Furst is on it. Portly fellow, cowardly, extremely reticent to get involved in any sort of action. So when they come on the scene, Chuck goes right in to investigate, and Charlie's just out there doing God knows what, talking about the weather or something.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
And the rest of the deputies are pretty ineffectual as well. And what we're left with is Chuck Norris to go track this guy down in the middle of the brush, kick his butt, hogtie him, and take him to the squad car, from which he escapes and then ends up in this incredibly violent shootout with cops.
Pumped full of lead.
And is presumed dead and taken to the local facility.
Dead, so, or that, at least dying. Yeah. Not very long for this earth. And
yeah.
He's taken to the local facility, which, for some reason, happens to be a genetic engineering hospital. So we have this very, very, you know, as like very rural Texas town with once again, a really great cop, a really terrible deputy. Does seem there's a diner there where Stephen first eats many a meal. Yeah. At one point, you see him eating a couple of burgers. Chuck Norris comes in. He orders a burger, hold your onions. Charlie asks if he can have his onions. Yeah. So there's not much going on in this town, but for some reason, there is a genetic engineering hospital which they take patients that have been shot to shit and are on death's door.
I'm immediately reminded of the car accident scene from Rabbit, where similarly there's this bizarre research institute. It's seemingly in the middle of the Quebec wilderness with nary a road to be seen, and yet a car accident victim is taken there to a research center instead of, say, a trauma unit somewhere instead. No. This victim here, taken here, and you know something is afoot because a research hospital.
Well, and I mean, the coincidences just keep piling up, because not only is this a genetic engineering / research hospital, but the doctor, the psychiatrist, the therapist that
has been treating Kirby,
Treating Kirby, that he was calling up at the very beginning of the movie, also happens to be a surgeon who was trying to extract the bullets.
That story checks out. So this is a small town. Maybe the sheriff deputy doubles as a bartender as well. And so this guy's doing, he's a therapist come surgeon. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe he's some kind of genius who's specialized in multi disciplines in medical school.
And he's a serum
wizard
yeah. as well. Because one other thing this film has is, see, because the thing is too, I mean, when you have a genetic engineering hospital or a genetic research hospital in genre film, they're never doing anything good.
Right? No. Yeah, why can't they be doing stem cell research to try and cure Alzheimer's? No, they're trying to fashion some kind of incredible Frankensteinian being. The serum causes pretty much instantaneous resolving of scar tissue and wounds. And they want to keep this, obviously, on the down low and free from the prying eyes of the police. So they try and shoo the investigating officer, Chuck Norris, away and just saying, oh, he's really dead, and he's pressing for the certificate, and he wants to make sure everything's
on. Well, he wants the body, right?
Yeah.
Lieutenant Dan, or whatever you would want to call him. Sheriff Dan wants
the... Sure, yeah. He wants the body.
He wants the body, but they don't want to give the body up because their ultimate goal is to fully resuscitate him and make him into this super warrior that's impervious to all forms of physical harm, is possessed with super strength, and
So, and it's par for the course in these types of movies, as we've seen with Dr. Herbert West from Reanimator. When you have some kind of serum and you inject it, and it's a revivifying serum, you know something is going to go wrong. And sure enough, this very violent, full of rage, full of rage-a-hall, this figure of Kirby busts loose from his confines and is back out on the streets causing havoc. And his first victim, of all people, is his psychiatrist. So he breaks into his house, I believe kills his wife, kills the psychiatrist, and we have a situation here, to quote a Tony Soprano. What can be done about this almost Terminator-type fellow, this unstoppable force, this immovable object? What can be done?
Well, I think Chucky is the immovable object, unstoppable force, or however you want to say it.
So what you have is these two polarities in this film. You have, on the one hand, this very POV, very dark, very almost, dare I say, Halloween-esque killer on the loose. And then on the other hand, you have almost this happy-go-lucky cornball cop who's new to the town, is sitting in the diner, who is made fun of for ordering a tea in the diner by a bunch of street toughs, who he chases out of town by giving them a thorough ass kicking.
What an ass kicking that
this is.
This
is almost like, you know, Stone Cold with Brian Bosworth, mm-hmm. or one of these other redneck in a you know, shitty spit and sawdust saloon type movies. I'm thinking the Roadhouse almost. So you have these two competing forces where you have this cop who's showing off his prowess with the fists and with the kicks.
Showing it off, but I mean, the Chuck Norris in this film, again, I'm going to call him Lieutenant Dan, or Sheriff Dan, really. He's definitely, I mean, the title Silent Rage, of course, refers to the antagonist, Kurt, because once he becomes revivified, what have you, he never utters a word.
Yeah.
But Chuck Norris, he's never been the most verbose thespian ever. I mean, I'm still waiting for his definitive take on, you know, the Hamlet, but
he's not going to be in Usual Suspects as verbal either, so I mean, yeah,
but he's a sort of guy. I mean, he does talk softly and carry a big stick, and mm-hmm. in Chuck Norris's case, his big stick is his fists and his feet. And you mentioned this bar fight, and again, it's hilarious because he shows up to this bar fight with his deputy in tow, and yet again he does nothing. The deputy stays outside. He does tell him, please call backup.
Yeah.
And in the ensuing conversation calling for backup, he spends more time talking about the mammaries of one of the bikers. You know,
yeah.
More time talking about her breasts, because he actually was about to give him a little squeeze before Chuck stopped him, than he does actually getting backup.
If there ever would have been a tension diffusing moment to preclude any fist from flying in a bar, would be the showing of breasts. So the bar fly biker chick flashes the deputy Charlie, and you would think, okay, let's have a few laughs, we can go about our merry way. But no, this precipitates one of the great, I would say, bar fights I've seen in a long time, and full of one cliche after another, just piling up.
Well,
you gotta love.
It was one cliche that finally got Charlie the deputy to call for some backup, and that was somebody going through a plate glass window.
Oh, you gotta have the plate glass window, and of course, you have to have someone both thrown over a bar, mm-hmm. smashing all the bar stuff in the background, your vodkas, your wine coolers, your gins, your all your spirits, and then you have to have the lattice work. There's probably a seat with a banquette, and it always has lattice work above it. And what better way to break someone's fall when you're grabbing them by the lapel and maybe the belt, and you're flinging them through somewhere? If they're extremely, extremely unlucky, they go through the window. If they're much luckier, they go through the lattice work mm-hmm. within the bar, and maybe can brace their fall on maybe a table or, again, the banquette.
Now, is it just me, but every time I see a bar fight in a movie, especially a movie of this sort where, you know, your kick-ass hero comes in and lays waste to dozens upon dozens of goons. And then, you know, they sort of wipe their hands and say, okay, we're done. It's all good. And I always think of the poor small business owner, the bar owner, who's left to clean up this mess. Yes, okay. You know, the ne'er-do-well bikers are gone. But meanwhile, all your inventory is destroyed. Your entire establishment.
It's true, but I'm sure this
which
is
may
not...
have been, may have been a family business, bequeathed from generation to generation.
I'm sure, like the Double Deuce, this is not the first nor the last time where this guy's inventory has been laid waste to by a bunch of toughs. What I always concern myself with is the poor last fellow who decides to come in. So biker gangs are structured where you have like the top dog, then you have the enforcer. Those guys would rush in first, presumably.
Fools always rush in.
Yes. And then after like the third, fourth, fifth guy.
Why is it always one at a time? Yeah. It's like they're fighting him using the ancient martial arts technique of one at a time.
Well, I was also thinking maybe the 18th century rules of combat, where you would pick a place. And
Queensbury rules?
I was thinking more...
Or Pistols of Dawn? Sort of thing.
Well, even I was just thinking with armies. They would say, okay, we're going to meet, let's say, at Waterloo. You will be there with your forces at 1 p.m. I'll be there with my forces. Let the best... cavalry slash whatever win.
Okay, this isn't Braveheart. This is a Chuck Norris ass kicking movie.
But I always think about the sixth guy to run in, because he's seen five of his compatriots get beaten like a rented mule, and yet he goes in with guns a-blazing, with nary a concern for his personal health. You would think after not one, not two, not three, not four severe ass whoopings, you would think, okay, the greater part of valor, whatever it is, that whatever that phrase is, you're going to hightail it out of the place. Mm-hmm. And when Charlie's backup call finally comes through, really, what's left to do except maybe escort a bunch of bikers to an attending ambulance? Because all these guys have been laid out on the bar floor amidst shards of glass. There's nothing for backup to do. These guys have had their asses handed to them.
You know what? Thank God they weren't taken to the genetic engineering hospital.
Well, then they'd have a super army of bikers. And these guys are tough as hell.
I mean,
oh, that would have been, yeah, really problematic.
Kirby enough. It was enough, of, enough for
one town to handle, that's for sure.
Exactly. So, but yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of things going on here, a lot of moving parts. So we have this bar fight, but we also have the saga of Kirby. And of course, there's that nefarious serum, which, if I'm not mistaken, was kept in what looked like a mason jar.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've developed a serum that has the ability to not only resuscitate someone at death's door, someone who's, for all intents and purposes, a vegetable, but also give them super strength and invulnerability, would you not think it would be held in something just a little bit more?
Keep it under lock and key, for sure. Or even at least refrigerated.
A little more sanitary than it looks like something you would hold preserves on any other day of the week.
Oh, it's true.
And, I mean, there's a little bit of talk back and forth between the three doctors who presumably developed the serum, one, of course, being the psychiatrist as well, who's played by Ron Silver. Now, Ron Silver is one of these actors that I remember seeing a ton in the 80s, and yet I can't think of a single credit right now.
Yeah, he's sort of like a poor man's Al Pacino in a kind of way, like early Al Pacino. He's got the beard, he's kind of cool, he's kind of Mediterranean. Yep. But
I was going to say a little swarthy, but is that,
very much so. Yeah.
I remember he was in there's a film called Reversal of Fortune. I remember that being a big one in the 80s, Barbie Schroeder or whatever. But he does have a winning beard, as does Chuck as well.
Yeah.
So we got two good beards in this one as well.
Yeah.
And so you got to have the derrigor, you know, like, how should we do this? I mean, are we playing God? And of course, you got to have the one scientist who, come hell or high water, it doesn't matter how much collateral damage, how many people are going to be laid to waste. We are doing this. We are creating this this super being. And, of course, it never ends well.
No, and as one doctor is quoted saying, we are scientists, not moralists. So that was a great line there. And so against
this, he follows up by saying, I don't care, because he was confronted by saying, people are dying. He goes, I don't care if 100 people die.
Ooh.
Because we're scientists, not moralists. So,
well, against this backdrop is, again, so you have this murderer on the loose who's this kind of quasi-transhuman cyborg killing machine, unstoppable force. And then the backdrop of this almost a buddy pick and of Chuck Norris romancing the sister of the psychiatrist in a very weird fashion.
Stone for a second. Yeah. There, but yeah.
And there's like this lengthy, lengthy montage of lovemaking,
oh,
which is incredibly bizarre. And it ends up in a hammock. And I know I'm not going to do a Simpsons reference there with the hammock annex, but there's this just very awkward and protracted, like, whispering sweet nothings.
That
between
love montage.
It went on forever.
We always talk about shifts in tone and so on and so forth. And this is supposed to be an asking action film with some sort of horror elements that you would assume would appeal to a male demographic.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they shoehorn this uber cheesy love montage. It looked like something out of a 70s shampoo commercial or something, where, you know, you got Chucky making love with a tray of apples and champagne.
Yeah, which he gently brushes aside so it doesn't quite fall off the bed, but it's just there, you know, just to get out of the way of his, like, the thrusting.
Yes.
Oh my God.
They're swinging a hammock, as you said. They're drinking wine overlooking beautiful Everglades forest. All set to the tune of a song called It's the Time for Love. I mean, this was plopped out of nowhere. So, it's not the time for love, because we have Kirby on the loose and he's on the rampage and he is going to kill until he's stopped.
This is true. Yeah, so I guess this is the point of the discussion where we can segue into what we've learned, because I've learned a lot, and it'd be great to do a little deep dive here.
Mm-hmm.
So, Fat Charlie, this corpulent fellow, ineffectual, useless deputy, this poor town has to make do with these absolutely useless law enforcement officials. Fat Charlie, they build up his relationship with the Chuck Norris character, very broad, gradually, and they really draw out the kind of buddy pick elements of this. And he
it is sweet. Yeah, because I mean, Charlie is completely useless, 100%, and yet for some reason, it's almost like Chucky adopted this little damaged puppy dog under his wing.
Well, he keeps giving him pep talks.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the guy is a very reluctant law enforcement officer. And he really doesn't want to be there. He is does not want to engage in fisticuffs. He doesn't even want to shoot. He doesn't want to do anything. Mm. And they have this very odd discussion about how when Fat Charlie was a kid, he was responsible for ending the life of a family pet.
This is hilarious.
Very bizarre. Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is, I think, in the aftermath of the bar fight when Charlie did absolutely fuck all. And he's apologizing to Lieutenant Dan. And I'm just going to keep saying that because I guess I got Forrest Gump in my mind right now.
Yeah.
But I should go see a doctor about that. Forrest Gump in my mind. But anyway. And he apologized. Oh, sorry, I didn't do that much. Oh, you did fine yesterday, Charlie.
Yeah, if by doing fine what? You mean ogling the breasts of a biker chick. And
for some reason, Charlie is so tortured about something that happened in his past that he has to unburn himself, almost as if he's in confession. And it's funny because he starts the story by saying, this is something I didn't put on my application. And I'm thinking to myself, again, sheriff's deputy application. This is not like when I was 14 years old walking to McDonald's asking for a job application.
Huh.
I would assume there's like an academy, you select the best candidate.
Yeah, I would say his psychological profile would preclude him from being hired onto the force. But again, if they're so desperate for bodies, then anyone will do, even people who accidentally kill their own pets.
Well, yeah, so Charlie, aka Lenny, because I mean, it's very, very a Mice and Men, this story's about to tell. He admits to killing a dog by, washing in a machine and then putting it into a freezer or something?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. And yet, even that is forgiven by St. Chucky, so.
Yes, any help is good help, right? If you're undermanned and overworked by the biker denizens of this crappy town who are extraordinarily tough guys, and actually, I should say, they look the part. They're really tough guys, maybe not as badass as William Forsythe and our mutual favorite Stone Cold, but these guys look like guys you would not want to mess with in this town.
Remember, the bikers aren't the chief antagonist. The chief antagonist is Jack Kirby, and this is a man who's walking around in some sort of silver lame
spacesuit. Yeah, it looks like a fire retardant like jumpsuit. It's
like
very bizarre.
You would find this at a Planet 9 from outer space or something that the aliens would be wearing. And for some reason, when he's going on his rampage, he has slick back hair.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why. As he's breaking out of this Jenkins Junior Hospital, did he find a tube of Depp gel or something? I got to look my best before I go out there.
Well, I got to say, he cut a little bit of a Warriors vibe of the lead gangster in the Warriors, and also a little bit Nick Cave. So he had this square jaw. He's ripped. You see him in all his musculature glory as he's sent through a body scan. I mean, he's an intimidating fellow. I mean, the parallels to Terminator, for sure. Like, he's definitely a force to be reckoned with. Mm-hmm. He's a big dude. He's menacing. He's quite terrifying. And again, he would make, actually, I think, a much better horror antagonist than he does a sci-fi one. But he kind of bridges the gap between both.
Mm-hmm. And he definitely does, he's believable as a formidable antagonist for Chuck Norris. So that's for sure. What else did you learn?
I'm always on the lookout for weird bits of mise-en-scene. And for some reason, it popped out at me as we were in the psychiatrist's office, played by Mr. Silver there. And they have this famous piece of art in his office, and it's because I'm a fan, it's Picasso, old guitarist, and I don't know what significance that had whatsoever, but maybe I was just zoning out a little bit, and I was thinking, why? Because usually a lot of thought goes into the mise-en-scene, and I thought, why does this guy have a Picasso thing on his desk? But anyway, I'm just rattling off the things I've learned. I learned that, my God, when you're ordering a hot tea in a small town, you better not do so, because your masculinity will be called into question, because one of the toughs Yeah, it just says hot tea. Whoa, you some sort of sissy or some variant of language thereof, right?
Well, it's interesting.
What's wrong with tea?
It's interesting that you specified a hot tea. Would an iced tea be more acceptable in a small town?
A cold tea? I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe Long Island?
But the guy's on duty. He can't be seen drinking. Like, there's very few options available to you.
Charlie can be honking boobies, but Chucky can't be drinking a cup of coffee. I mean, come on, man.
Oh, my God. I don't know, but it just seems so funny that... And also, they're so willing to just antagonize law enforcement. Like, in the bar, the preceding the bar fight, there's all these barbs thrown at law enforcement. They have no fear of these guys whatsoever. And I guess you could understand why. They greatly outnumber them, but usually when law enforcement comes on the scene... Things are pretty muted, and the dialogue is ground to a minimum, to a nothing, and you just go about your business till the cops leave. But these guys were just letting them have it verbally, and they ate their words, that's for sure. What did you learn?
They ate their words, and they ate a lot of Chuck Norris's food in their mouth. But yeah, I learned a few things. I mean, first of all, Charlie does have a bit of a story arc. I mean, he does evolve a bit, and he does become a little bit more efficacious as the film goes on. At one point, Allison, that's the
love interest
of Chucky, is in a hospital, and Charlie is to watch over her, and he takes his job very, very, very seriously. So seriously that he spends time in front of the mirror emulating the famous "Are you talking to me?" scene from Taxi Driver with his service revolver in such a clumsy way that it looked like he was going to drop it in any second and, you know, send bullets flying. But nonetheless, unfortunately, spoiler alert, he does get killed in the line of duty, because when Kirby does come to the hospital, he puts, and we just lost one of the greatest big men wrestlers of all time,
King Kong Bundy. May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace. I mean, big men wrestlers were always known for one move amongst all, and that was the bear.
Belly flop. Oh, okay.
King Kong Bundy's finishing move was, of course, the big splash and the five count.
And you can't discount a good solid buttocks to the face while you're in the turnbuckle, which is so unpleasant that I think I would just like tap immediately.
Have you experienced that a few times?
It looks so terrifying. I would rather have the potentially spinal cord injuring after effects of a pile driver than have the great Rikishi's behind crack stuck in my nose. Oh my God, that's so disgusting.
So yeah, he basically squeezed the life out of poor Charlie. And when Dan comes on the scene, and there's Charlie tearfully, I couldn't do it. And he's, and as his life is starting to drain out of him, there's
Chuck cradles him,
cradling him, consoling him, like as if he was this poor wounded duck or something. And Charlie felt so at peace at that point that he was able to expire in Chucky's
Hey, give credit where credit's due. As Allison is fleeing from Kirby, he does put himself in harm's way. And he does step out and give his life. Puts his body on the line to save her. So good on him, even if he couldn't really do much in terms of stopping the unstoppable force. So good on him.
Another thing I've learned when we talk about the magic of Chucky, Chuck Norris, I mean, yes, the man knows his way around a dojo. Yes, the man knows his way around a pair of short shorts. But what about the magic finger of Chuck Norris, the finger in the ear when it comes to seduction?
Ooh.
Hey, you're looking at me completely confused right now, but Allison is somebody with whom he's had history with. Apparently they were in
They were together for years
ago.
And yet she's still pining for him.
Well, not at first. She's a little reticent until he takes his finger and sticks it within her ear. And that was it.
Who knows? Maybe it's some as yet undiscovered erogenous zone. I do not know.
I don't want a finger in the ear. Every now and again.
I don't want your finger anywhere. But, another thing I've learned is that par for the course as well, when you have a Frankensteinian figure with his doctor creator, invariably they're going to meet.
This is
a wonderful scene.
Yeah,
and the psychiatrist says, "I've been expecting you. I've made history." So he doesn't figure that the monster will be that antagonistic toward him. You'd think, hey, a little gratitude, people. I brought you back from the friggin' dead after you're pumped full of lead by like 20 townie cops. You'd think, hey, just a little, maybe a card, maybe a handwritten note. Thank you for reviving me. I don't know, but no. Well, he takes his psychiatrist out.
Considering that he was pretty much mute at that point, I don't think he would be able to express thanks if he wanted to. He could have at least spared his life.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly.
Another thing I learned is there were kicks in this movie. There were kicks aplenty. I mean, that's, again, we talked about Jean-Claude Van Damme. He's known for his splits. When it comes to Chuck Norris, he's known for many different types of kicks.
Roundhouse. Yeah. Flying front kicks.
Drop kicks, front face kicks, roundhouse kicks. But I think that if you would say, well, what is the most iconic Chuck Norris kick, it would be the roundhouse kick. Mm-hmm. In this particular film, and maybe this was a conscious effort to make it less of a quote-unquote martial arts movie and sort of... there were less roundhouse kicks than I have come to expect from a Chuck Norris film. However, that's not to say this film was bereft of roundhouse kicks. I did count, there were 7.
Oh, wonderful.
7 roundhouse kicks. Finally, another thing I learned is that it's been established that this Kirby is a remorseless killing machine. I mean, at certain points during the climactic fight, it's almost hard to see who's going to come out on top. And yet, the way he's taken out is so ineffectively stupid that how can anybody, I don't want to say, but how can anybody think that that's going to prevent him from ever rising up again and wreaking havoc.
I thought it was good, but I don't know if it went well.
We won't touch on it anymore.
But I thought that was really odd. Yeah, especially given his martial arts bona fides, you would expect that would be the end of Kirby at the hands of, well, literally at the hands of this formidable fist. But but it wasn't, he didn't bend his knee to him because of those. It was for some other circumstance entirely, and that was really odd. But what do I know? I was trying to do some research on the director here. He doesn't even have a Wikipedia entry, although I thought he showed some incredibly deft touches on the horror front, and I thought, yeah, for a movie that's at cross purposes, and we always talk about tone on this podcast, tone is so tough to define. It's almost like the U.S. Supreme Court justice saying, I'll know it when I see it with regard to obscenity. We sort of know tone when we see it, and this is like half horror movie, half exploitation martial arts movie, and the times when they meet are odd, and it has a foot in both camps. It doesn't know what it wants to be, but that doesn't make it any less enjoyable. They could have emphasized maybe a little more of one than the other, but maybe there was something in post where they're tinkering. Who knows? This is a very strange beast.
Probably excise that Doublemint Gum commercial love montage entirely. yes, indeed. Definitely a strange beast.
Yeah.
So, star rating for Silent Rage?
Oh, my God. I so love it when someone grabs a pool cue and or a chair and goes after someone in a bar. Just, man, there's just so many weapons that you can just grab, from bar stools to bottles that you can break over people's heads to drinks trays. And, man, I just love a good bar fight. There's nothing better. And this one has maybe one of the top 5 I've seen in history. I'll say it that. I mean, it's tough to beat.
Number one, of course, would be...
Roadhouse. Or Stone Cold. Film. Oh, the Seagal film. Out for Justice. Gino Felino goes into a tough guy bar in Brooklyn and lays waste to everyone. I think whips a pool ball at one guy and talks shit to the bartender, who is an ex-boxing champ. He says, you da boxer? Yeah, show me. And just beats the living shit out of that. Oh, yeah, Out for Justice. Incredible bar fight. This one, again, man, a smile on my face. I'm going to give this 3 broken vodka bottles over the noggin out of 5. So really fun movie. Again, across purposes. Doesn't know what it wants to be, but interesting to see the ever stoic, the not particularly loquacious, but and yet manly, strong, silent presence of Chuck Norris in the lead role.
And the other thing too about Chuck, I mean, before I give my star rating, is he was never like, I mean, yes, I mean, the man is imposing, but he's imposing because of what he was never the most physically, he was never like this roided out sort of like Arnie or Sly in their prime, you know. I mean, the man, you know, he had some muscle tone, but yeah, he never really was like this real sort of like hulking beast in that sense. So he really let his feet do the talking in his career. And I mean, not being the most learned Chuck Norris fan, I've only seen a handful of his films. And I've been very terrible lately in the sense that I just like I've been really responding to films that just make me happy, that make me smile, like give me entertainment. And this one did that in spades.
Yeah, and you've been responding with your wallet as well, because you bought...
No, I didn't buy it. It was sent to me by one of our favorite listeners, DM Elms.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, well, a shout out. Thank you. I thought you went out and bought this. Okay, well, thank you so much.
It was recommended, and then it was sent, so for sure.
Wow, excellent.
It's with pride in my collection now, but yep, thank you, DM, for this one, for this recommendation, and I am giving this one, once again, I did it last week, I'm doing it again this week, 4 stars.
Incredible.
Or should I say 4 roundhouse kicks to the solar plexus? I don't know.
Why not? And man, there's some serious ass kicking in this movie, and we hope you enjoy our ass kicking podcast as well.
Some serious fashion faux pas as well.
Oh, as always. And tune in every Friday for new episodes of the show. We're going to be bringing you a little bit more on the action front this summer as we roll into 2019. Summer is, well, action season. I like to see people's teeth knocked out in the summer, especially. Just as much as I like to see ruthless, sinister, serial killer antagonists in the months leading up to Halloween. So on the horror front, this is just perfect. Look forward to that, and we're going to bring you more of those. So listen to the podcast, follow us on Twitter, Awful_Movies, and Facebook as well, and send us your suggestions for action flicks that we should be covering. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.